This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. We want to once again thank Richard Rosen for joining us for a couple of minutes. Customarily, Senator Bob Hedlund's State House report, but we want to get one of our sponsors in there. If you have a chance, stop on down to McGuigan's Pub, located in downtown Whitman, 546 Washington Street.
And also, customarily, he brings pizza in, but instead tonight he teased us with the pizza on the other end.
Well, see, here's the thing: I was actually going to try to see if we could get one of the folks who are going to be coming in later on to talk football to kind of pick up some pizzas, but that particular gentleman was up in Braintree.
No, that's fine. I'm making the point because the pizza at McGuigan's is excellent.
Well, I know you usually speak with your stomach, and I can understand that. I'm a guy who does the same thing sometimes. Joining us right now, this gentleman, you may have seen him in the local newspaper, The Enterprise, as he does a regular column. You might have a child who's over at his school, Southeastern Regional Vocational Technical High School. I think I kind of mumble-jumbled that, but he's the principal of that institution, and he's also an author. We have Mr. David Wheeler and his posse are here. How goes it, Dave?
Great. How are you, Kevin?
Doing pretty good.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit of, give us a self-bio of yourself.
A bio of myself?
Yeah, give me a bio of yourself. How long have you been in this area as far as...
Well, I'm from Brockton.
Okay. I
lived there all my life.
Okay.
Started out in life wanting to be a cop, have a degree from Northeastern in criminal justice, and quickly realized that wasn't for me. Ended up in education. I taught at Bristol Plymouth Vocational School for about 6 years. Worked for the State Department of Education for a couple of years, and then I became the principal at Southeastern.
What's it like to be the principal of OTEC? I mean, it's not like a regular high school because, you know, you got kids who go in there who are looking for life skills that they're going to take with them once they get that piece of paper, you know, after, you know,
graduation. I can't imagine being a principal anywhere else. I can't, you know, like a traditional high school, it seems so foreign to me. You know, I walk around the school and I see kids with, you know, fire and metal and building structures and, you know, putting on plays and video production and all that. So in addition to the, you know, English classes,
sure,
math classes, stuff like that. So, yeah, there's always something exciting going on.
I guess I would ask you, what got you into writing? Is it your career as somebody who was a teacher, or have you always had a love to write and express yourself as to things that you see?
When I was teaching web design, I was trying to get the kids to understand that it's content that makes a website, not, you know, necessarily the bells and the whistles. And in fact, those things slow them down a lot of the time. Mm. And I couldn't think of anything to do, so I said, I'm just going to start doing a little blog. So I had a blog for about 5 years called Strange Language, and it was great. I loved it. I had so much fun with it, a lot of friends.
Sure.
And that just kind of morphed into, I really enjoyed writing. And then I started realizing, yeah, blog is only so much you can do on a blog.
Right.
So I wanted to do some longer pieces, and that's how I ended up getting into the Enterprise.
Okay. Yeah. Now, was you approached? Now, Steve Damish is the managing editor. Did he approach you? Because it's nothing new for them to approach the high schools. I believe Brockton High School has their own page that they do once a week. I believe Bridgewater Raynham has started doing something, and then having you do your column.
Yeah. Actually, I approached him.
Okay.
And originally they had talked about, yeah, do you want to do a weekly, this is what happened this week, and blah, 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 and I wasn't really into that. I was like, no, I want to do something that's relevant to the issues and talk about things that are going on in education or the community of Brockton. So I sent him 3 or 4 samples, and he said, sure, let's do it. And it's coming up on a year now that I've been doing it. It's
challenging it. I mean, you're being somebody who's an educator and administrator. Yeah. Do you have to use great care in how you mince your words? I mean, do you really have to be careful? Or do you, depending on what the particular subject is, you know, did you feel that you pick something that's safe, that you won't have any controversy?
No, I don't mind controversy at all.
Okay. right.
It seems to find me anyway. I'm lucky we have a great school committee. I have just an awesome superintendent who just lets me do what I need to do. And I need to do this.
George Lopes? Lulopes. Right. I was a Lopes officer.
Just a super guy. I'm sure there's a lot of superintendents that would kind of micromanage their principals and want to know what they're writing in the paper. And he's never once asked me, you know, what are you doing? Occasionally, you know, I've hit some hot button issues here and there. I try to tone it down, with the exception of when I talk about local stuff. You know, Brockton has the highest foreclosure rate in the state of Massachusetts, has since 2008. And I write about that. I try to do it, you know, every couple of months, put something in there and kind of push our leaders to do a little bit more because I think it's a crime. And I'd like to see Brockton come back and be something.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what content you normally write about in the paper. So do you focus on mostly issues around, you know, your area where you're living, or do you focus, you know, state, national issues?
Yeah, well, this week, today's, I wrote about the federal policies affecting MCAS. So, you know, kind of a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
I might, from there, I think last week I wrote about the role of the school librarian and how it's changed. And that actually turned out to be one of my most popular pieces. I had librarians all over the country were emailing me, oh, thank you. You understand what we do. So that was good. But, yeah, whatever kind of catches my eye when I sit down and something I've been thinking about for a couple days, and I'll sit down Friday morning, Saturday morning early. I'm an early riser. And, you know, if it's flowing, it goes in.
What sets you apart as a writer and an educator? I mean, what you know, in being able to use the skill when you write things, whether it's the column or the book we're going to talk about?
I like to just kind of put it out there, just be honest. I don't like long, flowery writing, you know, like this book you look through, you know, it's they're short, seven pages, that's the longest piece you'll find in there. I think that's all the attention span that people have these days. I know that's all the attention span I have these days, so I figure there's got to be some people like me out there.
Sure.
So it's that, it's, I don't know, I just do my own thing, and I just kind of look at it like, well, I had a teacher once tell me, you know, just write like you, and there's no one else like you, so just do what you do, and you'll be fine.
Have you found yourself becoming a mentor to any of your students who might have caught your column or know that you're somebody who writes?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate. We have a great faculty, and, you know, I don't push it on them. I rarely even mention it, but some of them, particularly the history teachers, some of them, when I write about civics or something going on in the city, they'll use it as an example. Some of the more motivational ones about vocational students going to college, they kind of latch onto that. But yeah, I've had a lot of students stop me in the hall and mention it. We have several students that are writing their own books, which I think is just fantastic. We have kids that write graphic novels, which is something I wish I could draw. I'd do a graphic novel in a minute.
Sure.
But I can't draw a stick figure, so that's out for me. But
join the club.
Of that. Yeah.
Guilty.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, this is something very interesting in regards to your book, and I believe that are you doing something in regards to some of the funds for this book?
Oh yeah, it's I'm giving it all to the school. We have a community service fund. We have this woman at school. Her name is Sharon, and every year, this woman amazes me with what she does for our students. She sets up, you know, giving trees where you adopt a family and buy them presents. Thanksgiving, we have our staff go out and deliver, I think, 20, 25 turkey dinners to, you know, students and families in need. So that's called the Southeast Community Service Club. So I started trying to think of a way that I could kind of support it a little bit, but also be a role model for kids and put something out there like, you can do this. If you can write, you can publish a book. You don't need a publisher. You don't need this, that, or the other thing. You know, and then I do all right as the principal, you know. I don't do this for money, just like anyone who does a little side thing. They don't really do it for money.
See what I do right here? Yeah. One of your posse would understand. We don't do this for money either. So
yeah.
if anything, we do this for the love of informing the community.
And I think that's been the biggest change that I see in this young generation. My son's friend, his name is Ian. He does this music they're into now called dubstep. I don't know if you know of it at all. It's kind of a mashup of sounds that they do.
Right.
And he was asking me about the book one day, and he said, well, you know, do you make any money on it? And I said, well, do you make any money on your dubstep? And he said, no. And I said, exactly. You do that because you love to do that. I do this because I love to do this. And that's what makes life interesting, is people being able to kind of have their own little creative endeavors. And I think this generation has such a great opportunity to do that with all the technology that's out there.
Mm-hmm. With the latest news regarding Lance Armstrong, and every time you turn around, there's a sports figure who's getting in trouble, do you feel that there's a need for, you know, maybe local people, for local people like yourself, for some of our kids to look up to?
I don't know. I don't know if I subscribe.
I mean, I'm not
that.
Trying to put you on, yeah. on such a, but you look at, a lot of times kids will follow that great sports star. Yeah. You know, they look up to them only to find out, you know, well, he was blood doping for 7 of his championships.
Right.
You know, and to have somebody like yourself who's genuine, who's not doing this for money.
Yeah, I guess, you know, you could say that that's a good lesson. I didn't set out to do that. I'm just, like I said, I'm just kind of doing what I'm doing and see what happens. But, yeah, I think kids just need to see people that they know, that they can just look at, just a little small thing, like, you know, I took some of my thoughts, I put it in a book, I figured out how to get it up on Amazon and go from there. You know, that's a real thing to them, where you talk about Lance Armstrong, and sure. that's not real, that's far away,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Are We Immortal Yet? Essays yeah. and Stories by David Wheeler. Give me a thought process of putting this book together.
Most of it was written between two hurricanes, Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Sandy. I start off with a little story about Hurricane Irene. I lost a tree, a very big tree, my favorite tree, in my backyard. And I recount my kind of, I was upset about it because the insurance company wouldn't pay for a tree. They'd be happy to pay for a fence
sure.
or a shed, but not a tree. And to me, the tree was more valuable. You can have the sheds and the fences, you know? Sure. And that kind of got me thinking about things like that.
Both products of the tree, no?
Both products of the tree, absolutely. Yeah, I never thought. I should write that down. Good one, yeah.
I have moments.
Yeah, good one. And so it just kind of went from there. There's a theme. There's about 20 essays and stories in there, and there's really a theme of what does it mean to live forever, to last forever? You know, when I move from... I'm fascinated with the idea that people will live forever someday. We're very, very close. We were just talking in the car about a war veteran who, quadruple amputee, who they've just transplanted 2 arms onto him.
It's incredible, the technology.
It's yeah. just incredible.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I was just watching the Stossel report on Fox the other day, and they had a guy on there talking about exactly this, yeah. where we are very close to being able to live millions of years, if not yeah. forever.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to happen. So, you know, kind of one some of the things an idea can be immortal, you know, and one of the things I talk about in there is this idea of vampires, and how it doesn't, they're more popular now than they were when they were first talked about back in the, you know, mid-1800s. You know, anything from an idea to a tree, there are some trees that have been alive 15,000 years. So I find all that fascinating. And then I couldn't figure out how to end the book. I kept writing about it and writing. And then finally I said, you know, I'm going to end it with a fiction piece about a little short story. What do I think the world will be like? You know, what's it going to look like, you know, 200 years from now? Mm. So that's how I ended it.
What were the challenges in putting this together? I mean, is this everything that you had written? Or is there a process where you compile everything, and maybe you and maybe you have somebody who helps you go through it? You not only make sure that it's grammatically correct, because you don't want to put out a book where there are errors all throughout, and then on top of it, you know, you want it to be a set amount of pages. What was that process like?
It's ugly. It's an ugly, ugly, ugly process. Anyone that thinks they're going to sit down and write a book from beginning to end is sorely mistaken. That's not the way it works. It kind of works on its own timeline. There's one other person that touched this book, and that is, her name is Mrs. Rasher. She was my high school English teacher at Brockton High School.
Very nice.
She's now retired. She works part-time for us at Southeastern, as a matter of fact. And she's a wonderful editor. She's honest. She's someone that everything I wrote, I would just hand to her, and she would just go through it with a fine-tooth comb. But aside from her, I'm the only one. I did the typeface layout. I designed the cover. I took that photograph that you see.
Sure.
And it was really a learning experience for me all the way. Even how you measure a binding. you know, how many pages it is, and you have to, you know, multiply it out by, depending on what color paper you're using, is even makes a difference in the width of the binding. So it was also, I'm a computer guy, so it was really kind of a fun thing for me too. I, you know, got to reconnect with a lot of programs I haven't used in a long time, Photoshop, Adobe InDesign, things like that.
This is in your first book. What did you learn from, well, first off, tell us, what was the title of the first book? Still available?
The first book is still available. It's on Amazon. They're both at Amazon. The first one was called The Incredible Irony of Being. And that one was, I took a lot of the things from the blog, that strange language blog we were talking about earlier, and kind of flushed them out a little bit. I don't know what I was thinking with that one, but I thought it would be a good idea to put a lot of dry, boring material at the front of that book and then put some more exciting kind of, yeah, I see the look on your face. I don't know what I was thinking either. I guess I was thinking it would be a little bit more.
Well, the only thing I think of, because I mean, I've dealt with music, and one of your posse who's here will probably identify with me.
They're not talking much. I don't know why.
I think they're your quiet support. We will identify them in a couple of moments. We still got plenty of time. But when it comes to music, if you're going to put an album together and you're going to give it to someone, to whether it's an A&R guy or if it's going to be somebody who can get it into the right hands, you probably want your best material the first one, two, or three. And if you're putting them to sleep the first one, two, or three, then no chances are they won't get it to fourth or fifth. So you would say...
So I learned.
So you learned the valuable lesson.
I learned a very valuable lesson.
Very cool.
And I cut a lot of the dry stuff out, to be honest with you. People don't want to read it. Yeah. They just don't want to read it.
Well, I think if you mix it in, I think, you know, you kind of mix it in and kind of change it up, maybe.
People want a story.
Yeah.
They want a story.
They want a good story.
They do. They want a good story. And that's how we, as people, learn. We
a compelling
learn from
story.
Stories. Yeah.
So you learned that. What else did you learn as far as... Because you're self-published.
Yeah.
So what was it like... So what other things did you learn during putting together the first book and this one?
That my thought process is not necessarily the reader's thought process. And that's where, you know, my editor, Mrs. Rasher, was great. She would just little notes saying, you didn't connect this at all. I know where you're going with this, but people who don't know you won't.
Sure.
That's key for a writer. You can't just let people who know you read it. It has to be people who don't know you, aren't involved in your everyday life. So that was a big one for me. What else was big? The typeface was really a problem for me, like how it was laid out. I became more obsessed over that.
Palatino Linotype, size 11?
Yeah, and I actually put it in there because a lot of
I
books...
saw that.
A lot of books, yeah, that's good. Yep. A lot of books don't do that. They don't put the typeface they use, and I kept looking at books at home that I liked, and I was like, what is this typeface? And then finally, you know, I could never figure it out, so I just picked one that I liked, and I figured, well, maybe if someone likes this, they'll know what I used. So that's why I credited the typeface.
Another thing I noticed is, you know, just two pages in for Jason.
Jason's my brother.
Okay.
Jason's my brother, yeah.
Is he still with us?
He is.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is it about your brother that you said it was for him?
My brother got a tough diagnosis of cancer. He's younger than me.
Wow.
Yeah, a real tough diagnosis. And sometimes writing is just a way of also just sitting down and kind of processing through your thoughts. I have a whole other list of writings about that I haven't really done anything with yet. But that's when I found the theme of immortality kept coming back to me. And it was coming back to me. It wasn't me going back to it. Mm. It kept coming back to me. The title didn't, you know, come through to the end after it was all done. And I looked at it and said, well, of course that's what I'm writing about. I didn't even know it at the time, but that's what I was writing about.
So not only would you say you were questioning your own immortality or just in general?
Just in general. I spent the summer in New York, and New York is one of the last places in the world that has a lot of used bookstores that you can kind of just, you know, lose yourself in if you're a reader. And I came across this author that I had never heard about before. Wendell Berry is his name. And he's one of these guys that he's from Kentucky. He grows all his own food. He writes and lectures, and he had just somehow slipped by me, so I picked up a book of his essays. As soon as I read it, he started talking about any good writer is going to talk about their place. Whatever your place in the world is, that's where you are. That's what you write about. And the minute I read that, I said, that's what was missing in my first book. I was projecting myself into other places instead of just being honest and saying I live in Brockton. this is my life. I'm a high school principal. These my friends are in the book. You know, as you flip through it, you'll see some friends' names and people that I colleagues that I work with. Small snippets of conversations that we've had. And once I started doing that, it really opened up for me.
Where did you come up with some of the titles? I'm like looking through. I mean, one of it's Adventures in Toilet Repair. I'm like, that seems like interesting. You know, there are different ones that you have in here. You know, about being in New York, A Tree Falls Redux. I mean,
sometimes they just come to you. You just write it, and as you write something, you go, ooh, that's a great line. That's going to be the title. Sometimes the title just pops in your head for Adventures in Toilet Repair is probably a good one. That popped in my head. My toilet did break, and it was an ordeal trying to fix it myself. I might be the principal of vocational school, but I'm not very...
you're not good with those vocations.
I have a healthy respect for what they do, trust me. And as soon as that happened with my toilet, and it took me about 3 days to figure out how to fix it, and, you know, 5 trips to Home Depot, you know the drill.
Sure.
The title just popped in my head. I was like, this is really an adventure. Yeah, yeah. So that's pretty much how it happens.
I just like the creative. I mean, maybe I sound like a 5-year-old kid going, why? How come? I want to know the creative process that it went. I mean, it looks like a lot of hard work went into this. And you know what? I mean, I thought about writing a book, but I mean, I write for a living from time to time, whether it's providing news pieces here or other outlets, but it's a chore. And I'm very, very, you know,
it is
very meticulous, and for someone to put together a 70, 80, 200 page book, it can feel like a lifetime.
It's a lot of work. Even after the first one, I thought the second one would come easier. It didn't. In fact, it was a little harder in some places. I can't imagine how. Think about Stephen King. How does that man do it? You know,
Do you worry about redundancies or anything that you didn't want to, things that you didn't want to do with the first book, maybe stories or?
I used to, and then I read a great line. If you're a writer, you better read self-help writing books like from other writers. And I read this absolute line, and it might have even been Stephen King's book on writing, where he said, you know the times you sit and you're obsessing over, you know, should I use this word or that word, or end with this sentence or that sentence? Guess what? No one cares but you.
Right.
The reader is just going to read right through it and keep going. You're the one that's stalling the process by sitting there. And as soon as I read that, that was another kind of big step for me.
The levee opened wide.
Yeah.
Well, we got a couple of minutes left here. You've brought some guests. I'd be interested to know who they are and how they had a role in either writing the book or how they're instrumental in your everyday life over at Southeastern.
Well, to my left is Peter Zimbor.
TV guy.
Hello.
He's actually a TV, sometimes radio guy.
That is true. Yeah.
Peter teaches video at the school.
Fitting,
yeah. And Peter and I connected probably his first or second week there when I was just so excited to have some of these creative vocational programs. And he's been someone that's helped me make contacts yourself. Yep. You know, he's just been wonderful with that. And then to my right is Chuck Burgess. Chuck is someone who we dragged out of retirement. He was in the Boston school system for a long time. He finds jobs for our kids. He finds cooperative education jobs. And I've known Chuck for, I don't know, 6-7 years now. And Chuck's a writer. Chuck has 3 published books of his own. And my first book, Chuck and I would talk about, and he was kind of a sounding board for me and a bit of an inspiration for me to say, you know, you can have a full-time job and still do this and still get it done.
A matter of just pecking away at it, maybe doing a page or two here and there, what?
It's a matter of just sitting down and doing it. You just have to sit down and do it. That's the key. So many people talk about it.
Mm.
You know, oh, someday I'll write a book. Well, you know what? Wake up early in the morning, sit down and start writing.
Peter, what are your thoughts on Mr. Wheeler, you know, as far as putting this book together?
Dave Wheeler is a very creative person. He's come into my classroom many a times with these short little essays that he's written, some of them fiction, where he thinks this would make a good skit, and we kind of bounce ideas off one another. I think it's cool to have someone head the school that's creatively inclined because, you know, my mind goes places like that sometimes as well.
You're a creative guy yourself. I mean, it's, you know, you're not rolling out your resume here, but you've had a chance to speak with different people and being around people. So being around someone him kind of Would you kind of put them in the mold of some of the people you've had a chance to cross paths with during your time in TV and radio?
As a matter of fact, just today I was listening to what is probably the beginnings of a podcast he's going to put together, and I thought it was hysterical. I thought it was something that would fit right in with many of the programs that you and I had been a part of in the past.
Sure.
I thought it would fit right in with our audience.
What types of things would you say would they be pop culture?
I don't know if I want to go into the particulars of the one I was listening to today, but he was sort of just, you know, making light of one of his good friends' day-to-day dealings.
Oh, okay.
I have a friend who was laid off and has found himself in he qualified for a federal retraining program. So he's in this program during the day, and he's been telling me about some of the characters in and out of this program that he sees and interacts with, and it's fascinating to me, just fascinating. So we've been recording little snippets of it here and there, and yeah, we'll see. Maybe something will come of it, maybe something won't. But
to this day, one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my entire life was something that someone was recording where they didn't quite realize they were being recorded, and it's the raw audio of a weatherman at 4:30 in the morning calling into Kevin's radio show to record the weather report that day after what we believe was a night of debauchery where he should not have been up at that moment. And I thought of that as I was listening to that today.
That is very true. And that's one of these days that we'll find the light of day. But
to this day, Kevin, is that not one of the funniest things you've ever heard in your life?
That is. In another life in another station. You know, you calling and talking to the weather guy, and the weather guy normally, you know, being, you know, someone that you know, gives you the whole idea. I don't want to pull the curtain back, but, you know, he kind of gives you the down low as to what the weather's going
to
be.
But what I was listening to today was just so organic that it could not have possibly been scripted, and that's what made it funny.
But the particular weather guy was, he sounded as though he had way too many cocktails. And I'm like, I need you now. And he actually, he's like, no, I got to call you back. I go, dude, you call me back at 6 o'clock in the morning doesn't help me because I'm going to be on the air.
I think that's 100,000 hits on YouTube if you put it up.
You think so?
It was the greatest thing I've
ever heard. We'll have to collaborate. You know, Peter is, when Peter says something, usually I know Peter well enough that I would do it.
I do have to ask, how are, you know, this being your second book, how are both books doing out there right now?
They do okay. You have to constantly push it. That's the key. And, you know, where do you push it? Facebook, my blog. Who reads Facebook and my blog? My friends. So, you know, after a while, you feel bad about that. So I'm trying to push it in some other avenues, obviously, you know, coming on the radio, things like that. But it's doing all right. The second one is doing much better than the first. Much better. And digital sales and hard copy sales are exactly even.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. Even.
What is the book selling for? And where can folks go to? Is it strictly on Amazon?
Right now, it's strictly at Amazon. Okay. That will change. I'm probably going to print some other copies somewhere else. It's $9.99 for the paperback, and it's $2.99 for the download.
Okay.
And you can just search for it. Are We Immortal Yet?
Mr. David Wheel, I want to thank you very much for coming in. It's too bad we didn't get the other gentleman to come and talk, but at least Peter had a chance to kind of chime in.
Chuck's shy tonight. I don't know why.
That's okay. Well, we want to thank you for coming in.
Might have been
in.
The two beers at Fridays before we
it's okay.
got here.
If you have a chance, check it out. Are We Immortal Yet? Essays and Stories by David Wheeler. And if you haven't had a chance to grab the Enterprise, what day is your column usually in the
Mondays.
Enterprise?
On Every Mondays. Monday.
So if you haven't grabbed the Enterprise today, check it out. And we'll look forward to talking to you again, my friend.
Oh, thank you very much.
Here's David Wheeler.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station, 95.9 WATD-FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.